Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Martin Willis, your host, and we have a great show for you this evening. One of my favorite guests, we have Robert Powell coming up in just a bit. Before that, we have Alejandro Rojas. He'll be joining us for UFO updates in just a minute. And I want to thank everyone that helps support the show. And why don't the listeners check out, we have a lot of kind of interesting things on our website now, podcastufo.com. Go check it out over there. We are still looking for a blogger. I know we've had a few people contact us, and so that option is open for someone that would like to write some blogs. We did have someone in Tasmania write a couple of interesting blogs. I'm waiting to hear back from him. And let's see. We are talking the Nimitz today. I guess I'm kind of stuck on that case. I really like talking about that. It's just one of those fascinating ones with a lot of really great research, and Robert has done that. And on the 19th of March, I believe it is, we have Kevin Day, who is the radar operator in the Nimitz during the sightings. He's going to be on the show then. So I think that will just about do it for the Nimitz for us for a while. And last week, if you missed the show, check it out. It's pretty interesting. The fighter pilot was actually on the Nimitz during the incident. I didn't even know that when I had him on the show. I had him on to talk about other things, so that was pretty exciting for me anyway. So that's it for now, and we are joined by Alejandro Rojas. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me, my friend.
As always, it's a pleasure.
And you should have a great show. You've got Robert, and which is great because he's got this report coming out, and I'm so excited to see it. In fact, I asked him to share information with me, and he said, wait for the report. So you're getting a preview. You're lucky.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's part of that government documents book that was so important. But Nimitz is really important, too, because I think probably one of the most important cases in a long, long time. And the main reason being that it's tied to this government program. And then we have more witnesses than ever, you know, with this case coming forward. In fact, you know, even with if you think of a big case like Rendlesham Forest, which was a military case, you know, in the UK, the United States was leasing this base from the UK. You have quite a few military witnesses from that, but it didn't have the attention, nor was it an official kind of government investigation like Nimitz is. So there's just a number of reasons it's so, so important, and it's really exciting that it's getting all the attention. And so I think it's important that we talk about it a lot.
You make a really good point. I'm wondering if part of the reason Rendlesham Forest was not taking that seriously at the time is because it was not on our land. It was in England. I'm wondering if that's part of it. And I wonder what would change today if that happened.
That's a good question, and you're right. That's what's interesting about the Charles Holt memo and essentially the strategy behind the memo. So Charles Holt was the deputy base commander. He was one of the witnesses in Rendlesham Forest, and it was pretty much his memo to the Ministry of Defense that in the UK that broke this whole thing and made it very big. And in his memo, it was essentially he and his boss, their strategy was, well, you know, this incident didn't really necessarily occur on the base. It occurred on English land. So we're going to kind of pass the buck and write this memo telling them this occurred. So really, it's their job to investigate. Hmm. And then the UK decided not to investigate. There were debates, including in the House of Lords, one of the branches of the government, around why aren't they investigating it. But it never was officially investigated by the government. So you're right. I guess if the American government would have taken onus, if they would have written that memo internally, what would have happened? Maybe there would have been an investigation. Who knows? Hmm. It's difficult to say. Although Charles Holt believes there was some sort of clandestine investigation that went on that he was not even privy to. And I asked him, well, you think, you know, he believes his guys were debriefed. If that could happen, if some organization with a lot of secrecy could come on base and debrief his own people without him knowing. And he said, sure, that could happen. I just didn't have a need to know as to the business that these people were needed to do on the base. And so that's possible.
Right, right. It is pretty amazing how, when you said the need to know thing, how compartmentalized everything seems to be in so many different ways when it comes to the military and the government.
Mm-hmm. So getting into news, that gets into a little bit of the news. There's a somewhat of a tie in that, you know, ATIP, this organization was that Lou Elizondo, you know, ran. There's been some questions about it because we really haven't had much in the way of official documentation related to all of this. We've got leaks, for instance, many of them from George Knapp at KLAS. In fact, the only report we have, the alleged report we have from the military on the Nimitz case, is from a leak from George Knapp. Now, there have been other people to corroborate these leaks to confirm that they're accurate, but one of George Knapp's leaks was a list of different sort of products, they call them, different projects or papers that his organization was working on. And luckily, fortunately, we have finally had essentially the first FOIA, and you'll definitely have to ask Robert about this because I know he's been FOIA-ing like crazy around ATIP and Nimitz and all of this, and there's been little to no success, really no success until recently. And that is because of these documents that a couple of groups were able to FOIA and get information out of. Well, really only one that we know has FOIA'd it and gotten information. That's the Federation of American Scientists. So they did a FOIA on ATIP and they got some documentation. It turned out Nick Pope had called the PR department essentially and said, hey, guys, you know, I've got a FOIA, but give me some information. And they finally did. And it turned out to be the same document that the Federation of American Scientists had released. And that happens sometimes where a FOIA is responded to, which makes then that material public. And so then when you call the PR department, especially as a journalist, they'll often give you that material without having to have put through a FOIA. And other researchers, they'll do that for also. I'm sure that's happened to Robert. So they got this document, and this document actually mentions the name ATIP. It mentions Advanced Aerospace Threat and Identification Program, which is interesting because this term, it's been debated what the term is, but Lou Elizondo has told us it's Advanced Aerospace Threat, even though so many people doubt him for some reason that you know, ATIP did UFO work or anything at all. But there's a couple of important clues, and we've kind of talked about these documents, but examining them, there's some information in it that's pretty important. Essentially, they're looking for advanced aerospace threat and identification, meaning the identification part is they're identifying foreign objects, objects that don't belong to the United States. However, what's interesting then is, okay, who are these foreigners that have this technology that is beyond our own then that they're examining? Well, if you look at this inventory that to try to get a clue as to, you know, are they looking into Russian technology? Are they looking into Chinese technology? Well, all of these documents are all about space travel for the most part, at least when it comes to the technology parts, space propulsion. There's stuff about cloaking, but there's traversing wormholes and stargates. So you see here very quickly that, you know, it bolsters Lou's claims that what we have here is that they were looking at unknowns. They were looking at another possibility. He, of course, is hesitant, like many, to say they're looking into whether or not it's extraterrestrials, but at least they had, as he shared, been convinced that it's not the Chinese or the Russians or any other government out there that we know of. So it backs up. Of course, unfortunately, we don't have listed on this list like the Nimitz document.
Yeah.
And, you know, we have this Nimitz report. But what's exciting, at least from what Lewis said, is that the Nimitz report is one of very many, that there are other cases out there. I think Robert definitely knows, has a clue as to some of the other cases that they've looked at, given what we know about some of the videos that have been released. But supposedly, and according to Lou, there were even better cases than the Nimitz, and the Nimitz is an extraordinary case. So there's still a lot of information to that is forthcoming. And even when it comes to the Nimitz, we don't know the extent of the investigation. We have this kind of almost high-level executive summary that doesn't even necessarily look to be put together by a scientist, but more of a researcher or an investigator who talked to all of the witnesses. There's some kind of real fringy, kind of strange speculation in the leaked document, but Lou has confirmed it's accurate. And as time goes on, another reason this is helpful is that when Lou's the things that he's told us have been confirmed and corroborated by third parties like Harry Reid or David Fravor or any of the other Nimitz witnesses that we've talked to, then it just it means that most likely, you know, what Lou has been telling us is accurate. So when he's telling us there's more documents to come or that more exist, hopefully over time, you know, some of these FOIA requests that we've put in will be fruitful. And we'll be able to get some more of these exciting reports.
Right. Absolutely. Wow. I hope so. And it's, you know, that is fascinating. I mean, that there are so many military, I mean, the military involved in these sightings is fascinating to me. And and there's a lot
I think that's
of it.
A really important case, a point. You know, the UK government up until 2008 had their own UFO research program. That was the program that Nick Pope was a part of. However, they closed their door at 2008. In 2008, they didn't want any more documents. But Nick Pope, for instance, although he can't point to this being, you know, certainly the case, felt that more of what they were saying is they don't want public input anymore, that they've got enough information on their own. And it's kind of similar to what ATIP was doing, because ATIP was looking at military cases. And I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing, because when it comes to a military case, you're going to have more records, you're going to have more credible witnesses, you're going to have even more sophisticated equipment that is monitoring or gathering data, including video data on these cases. So these are going to be the strongest of the cases out there. And even if you look at Project Blue Book or a number of other cases that Robert has looked into and his colleagues in his government documents book that they've put together, you know, these are really, really strong cases. Do they point to an answer that we definitely know what's going on? They don't. But what they do point to is what Lou has shared and others is that there's a mystery. There's an observed technology that we don't know what it is. But so far, we have not seen anything, you know, indicating, like, at least officially, that they've captured a crashed UFO or bodies or anything like that. But we do at least have that it's very substantiated that they've had these experiences with these unknown technologies that can outmaneuver our most sophisticated aircraft.
Yeah. And do such mysterious maneuvers at that. You know, especially when we're going to be talking about that today at the Nimitz. Yep. Those are crazy.
I guess when it comes to news, you know, there's a lot of news about these documents, about the crazy stuff these guys were looking into.
Yeah.
They don't get into some of the nuances like we're talking about, where it confirms the UFO side of things. However, what's interesting about the mainstream media is they have had no doubt, really, as to what Lou and Elizondo has said about his program, or that Harry Reid has said about the program. They really haven't doubted Lou when he says they investigated UFO in the mainstream media. So I think that's really important. When it comes to the mainstream media, these stories, I think, are really interesting. And it's great that, you know, there's so much more getting out there. And people know that not only was the government or the military taking UFOs more seriously and the possibility that they're unidentified, but also these other technologies that would indicate how they might be getting here from there, but also how we might one day get there from here.
Yeah.
So all of that's important. But that's created a lot of stories. And then, of course, Blue Book is creating a lot of stories still. The Project Blue Book television show. In fact, there is a Washington Post story that just posted today. So we're seeing a lot of mainstream coverage from UFOs, mostly from Project Blue Book, the television show, but ATIP continues to get into the headlines as well.
Yeah, great. Well, Alejandro, thank you so much. It's fun, as always, to have you on the show. I appreciate it.
Yeah, my pleasure. Have a great show.
All right. I'll talk to you next week.
Talk to you later.
All right. Okay, everyone. So our guest tonight, oh, by the way, we were just speaking about the documents, and you can read those actually on my website. I have a PDF reader, so go to podcastufo.com, and it's titled, it's a second article down, FOIA reveals the DIA-funded research into UFO technology, and you can scan through that. It's only 5 pages, but you can scan through that document and check it out. It's really interesting. So our guest, Robert Powell, he is a charter member, a board member, that is, of the Scientific Coalition of for Ufology, SCU. He's been the director of research at MUFON from 2007 to 2017 and created MUFON's Science Review Board in 2012. And it goes on and on and on. He's quite a, and he's also part of the UFO Data Project as well. And we have a lot to talk about. Welcome to the show, Robert.
Well, hi, Martin. It's nice to be back.
Yes, I think, you know, you were on the show the week before the New York Times article came out, and all heck broke loose, as they say.
You're right. We talked about the event right before the New York Times released the case. It was kind of coincidental. Yeah. I had been working on it since the middle of 2016, and then you and I talked the week right before. What was it, December 17th or 19th?
It was 16th when that came out. So, yeah, it was the week before prior to that. So we have a lot of new listeners to the show, a lot of new listeners in the UFO field in general. So for the person, I want to start out by talking about the Nimitz case, and we will go into other topics, of course. But if for the new listener, in a nutshell, if you can talk about the Nimitz case, just and, you know, get them up to speed with, and then we can continue to talk about more details on that.
Sure, I could do that. And if you would like, for your new listeners, I could give them a quick overview of my background, just
sure,
so
yeah,
they
yeah.
know.
Yeah, go ahead.
You know, you didn't pick me up off the street corner somewhere.
yeah. Okay.
Actually, I became involved with the UFO topic in 2007. So I've been investigating it for almost exactly 12 years now. And I probably averaged 20 hours a week. My degree was in chemistry, and I became interested in this topic back in junior high when I read one of J. Allen Hynek's books. Oh. But, you know, I put that on the shelf. Because, you know, I had to get a job, raise a family, make a living. And I was fortunate in that I worked in the semiconductor field, making microprocessors. I was an engineering manager there. And I was able to retire early. And so once I retired early, I said, okay, what do I really want to do? And one thing I always enjoyed was the challenge of the UFO phenomenon. And so I got involved then. I became the director of research at MUFON. I was there for 10 years. Left there about 1.5 years ago. Then we founded the Scientific Coalition for Ufology. And it's kind of been history since then. And, you know, I look for cases that have a lot of good information and data. And the Nimitz case was one of them. Mm. So to give your listeners a feel for, you know, how did I get involved in this Nimitz case? Well, it started back in the middle of 2016. So I'd heard about the case then, and I found the website that a lot of your listeners may be aware of now, which was a Navy blog site. And when I found that site, it was just full of Navy lingo, and it was talking about this UFO case. And the first thing I do on any UFO case is I try to filter through, okay, is this even worth my time? And I could tell right from the beginning, okay, this is interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So I started investigating the case at that point in time. That blog site had a lot of good information in it, and – then I went and began sending out FOIAs. And I was on your show, actually, in December, right?
Mm-hmm.
When one of the guys who listened to your show, by the name of Kevin Day, contacted me. And he happened to be the senior chief who was over radar on the USS Princeton. And so just within a day or two of your show, he had posted something on your site. So I called Kevin, and then he told me basically his story of what happened. So I interviewed him in January of 2018. Hmm. And as far as I know, I was the first person that interviewed Kevin. And it's always good to try to get all the information you can in that first interview, because, you know, sometimes in our minds, right, it's easy for things to change. So you want to get that information while it's still fresh and virgin.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, this case involved a U.S. carrier strike group known as Carrier Strike Group 11. It was southwest of San Diego, right? Kevin Day was the senior chief over all the radar guys. And so he's doing his usual work. They're doing exercises, and he's detecting these objects on radar to their north and northeast up near Catalina Island, moving at 80,000 feet at about 100 miles an hour. So the first thing they do is they double check the radar. They make sure it's not, problems with the radar. And they, as far as they can tell, the objects are real. But they pretty much ignore it because it's over 80,000 feet and it's not really bothering them, right? Well, on the day when they're about to have an exercise, a number of these objects drop from 80,000 feet down to about 20,000 feet and some down to sea level. And the time it took was 0.78 seconds, which is the number that Kevin had written down and remembered till this day.
Wow.
So to me, that was really interesting, right? I've already read this blog about it. Now, Kevin's told me basically the same thing, and he has not seen this blog at that point in time. I'm like, wow, this is pretty interesting. So the next thing I do is I managed to get a hold of a guy who was what they call a fire control operator, which doesn't – you would think that means he controls fires on the ship, but that's not really what they do. They are basically part of the attack group, should they be at war. So these guys have access to the radar information too. And he basically tells me the same thing Kevin did. He didn't say 0.78 seconds. When I asked him how long did it take, he said, how long did it take you to put that thought together you just asked me? And he said, that's how long it took it to move down, to 20,000 feet. I said, okay, that sounds like about a second. So that's what kind of got me started on it. And we started putting everything together. We went and talked to Lieutenant Commander Slate, who was the other senior pilot, in addition to David Fravor, who was the commander of the squadron. And these two guys, and I apologize to your listeners the way I'm jumping around here, but I guess I've gotten excited about this whole thing. So to back up a little bit, right, radars picked these objects up. They verified it. A few days later, the objects are dropping down into airspace that an exercise is about to begin. So basically, at that point, Senior Chief Day goes to the captain of the ship, James Red Smith, and he says, okay, here's what's happening. I think we should engage these objects because they're a safety hazard. So the captain of the Princeton agrees. He contacts the Nimitz, and they send two F-18 Super Hornets from the USS Nimitz. And one of the pilots from that aircraft is the commander, David Fravor. And within the other airplane, sitting as the WSO, is Lieutenant Commander Jim Slate. So you got two senior guys, right, that are they're going out to check this. Now, they were actually already in the air when they received their order. So it's not like they just left the Nimitz. So they're already in the air, but they received this order saying, hey, we're going to divert you from your current exercise and send you to a real life situation. And so they head out towards this object.
Okay, can
that's
we
picked up on
right? We're going to take a break right there. So they're heading out toward the object, and that's where we'll pick it up after the break. We have to take a break now. So we're on with Robert Powell, and we're talking about the USS Nimitz, and we will be right back right after this break. All right, so we have 3 minutes, and we'll talk about other things in this, Robert, and we'll pick that up right when we go back. So I wanted to see if there's any questions in the – there isn't at this point. So one of the things I've mentioned when Alejandro and I were talking is there's – a number of military sightings, you know, and it goes all the way back. You can talk about the Foo Fighters back in, you know, World War II and all that. Why do you suppose there's so many military sightings? I mean, am I wrong to say that there's many of them?
No, you're not wrong. You know, it's really hard to answer that question. I mean, because on the one hand, I'm sure there's even more civilian sightings, right?
Yeah.
But the problem with civilian sightings, it's more likely you can get a false report, mm-hmm. which you don't get with the military.
Right.
And the other thing is, all at least in the past, all your military sightings got recorded. And of course, today that doesn't happen, at least not in the public vein. Until someone comes forth, like happened in this case.
Mm-hmm. And also, Alejandro mentioned that there was some probably more exciting, you know, encounters than the Nimitz. Now, I know that the gimbaled UFO image that we saw, you know, actually was out on the New York Times website, and everybody's seen it, I'm sure, by now. That one in particular, that was off of Florida, and that was also a military gun camera footage, right?
Right. That's correct. That was with another carrier strike group. In this case, the main carrier was the USS Roosevelt.
Mm-hmm. And there were some similarities. It sounds like there were some similarities because there was other objects just like, you know, in the Nimitz. Well, they didn't see a lot of other objects, but I mean, they did on radar.
And right, right. They and actually, I had a guy in the service and the Navy contacted me about that video right after it was released and told me about the four other videos that existed.
Oh, is that right? Wow.
Yeah.
I wonder how many we'll actually get to see.
Well, we got to see one more, which was what they called their fast...
Fast Walker or whatever it was?
Yeah, or whatever it was called, Fast Something, they named it.
Oh, I see. What were the particulars about that sighting in Florida? Do you know any more details about that?
I mean, the main thing I know is that there were four other videos, one being the FAST video, and there were three beyond that. But those have not been released.
All right, gentlemen.
Whether or not they ever will be released, who knows?
All right, welcome back. My guest is Robert Powell, and we are talking Nimitz right now. And just before we went into break, Robert, you said that they started heading out toward what they had no idea what these targets, so to speak, were. So you can bring, you know, go from there if you would.
Right. So at this point in time, you had two F-18 Super Hornet jets with two senior commanders in each jet, and they're heading to the southwest of the USS Nimitz, about 50 to 80 miles southwest. And they know their target's at 20,000 feet. They don't know what the target looks like. So they get to the point because they're in communication with the Princeton, which is the main radar system for that strike group. And then as they approach the target, the Princeton tells them you have merge plot, which means that on the Princeton's radar, the F-18s and the unknown are both at the same location, which means they're within 1,000 feet or so of each other. So the F-18s just start looking around. Okay, where's this target? We don't see it on our radar, but, you know, the Princeton tells us there's a target. So as they're looking around, they see this object in the water, which the water was described that day as almost crystal water, very still, no movement, no waves. But yet in this one area, it looks like there's something. It's almost what the commander thought was perhaps a commercial airliner had crashed and was under the water, and this was the water breaking over the jet.
Now, pardon me, didn't he also, it's not what I've seen, but I think I read somewhere that it almost looked like it had wings too, like going off to the side like a cross or something?
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. It's not clear to me exactly if he could truly make out the shape of what was under the water or not. Mm-hmm. But I have heard that.
Yeah.
But they do know there's water under the object. It's causing breaking of the water as the water slowly moves over it. So, you know, they're looking to see, okay, what's happened? Is a boat sunk? Is a plane crashed? And as they're looking, they suddenly see this other object just zipping around right over the water. And it's moving in a totally random manner, as Commander Fravor described it. It's almost like a ping pong ball, the way it moves around. I mean, it suddenly changes directions. And so he decides that he's going to head down and get a closer look, because remember, they're at 20,000 feet, because that's where the target was originally found. And he sees this object near the water's surface. So he drops down. Commander Slate and the other pilots stay at the 20,000 feet, and this kind of typical military operation, the way they operate in a combat type situation. So he drops down, and as he's moving down towards the object, Commander Fravor notes that this tic-tac shape, which is the way the object looked, suddenly it turns one of its points towards him. And to him, it looked like it recognized that he was moving towards it. And the object at that point begins to move towards him. And it's almost like they're doing a pirouette dance as he's moving down towards it. It's on the other side of a circle moving up towards him. Mm. And this continues, and they're always staying on the opposite sides of the circle. And at this point, he's probably around 10, 12,000 feet, and he decides to cut across the circle to get to the object. Well, at that point in time, as he's dropping down rapidly towards the object suddenly just makes a slight move, and then it basically takes off. And here's the key thing, as Commander Fravor described, is the object disappears in basically 1 to 2 seconds. And he described it as, you know, if you're at an air show and you're sitting there and jets go by you, it takes 10, 11 seconds before they disappear on the horizon. But he said this is not what happened here. This object was gone in 1 to 2 seconds. Well, meanwhile, right, you've got Lieutenant Commander Slate, who's up above from a totally different altitude, different perspective. He describes the same thing. He describes it as like a bullet shot out of a gun. Yeah. So you've got two experienced guys, two different angles, two different altitudes, seeing the same thing happen. So you either have to decide you don't believe these two experienced Navy pilots, or you decide you do believe them. And if you believe them, you've just had an object disappear at an extremely rapid rate, which you could calculate how fast you would have to move in order to disappear from sight. And that's one of the things we do in our report. So that's kind of the story in a nutshell. Mm-hmm. So to me, it kind of boils down to this. Did it happen? That's the first thing you have to ask yourself. Did this really happen? Mm-hmm. And in my mind, there's no doubt that it happened. I mean, you've got a senior chief over radar who says it happened. You've got the fire controller who saw the radar and says it happened. You've got an experienced commander of a squadron who graduated from Annapolis, and a lieutenant commander who graduated from Annapolis, both with several thousand flight hours, who see this from two different angles and saw it happen. And then to kind of top it off, later, about 2 hours later, another jet leaves the Nimitz, and Commander Fravor asks that pilot that if they can to take video, because that plane, unlike his, has a FLIR pod on it. And they pick up an object, which David Fravor and Jim Slate says is the same type of object they encountered, and that shows up on their video. So when you take all those together, right, you can kind of, you know, people like to say, well, maybe this didn't happen on a radar. Maybe this didn't happen with Commander Fravor. Maybe this didn't happen with Lieutenant Commander Slater. This didn't happen with the video. But you can't say all these maybes and combine them all together to try to explain away an incident that happened. So in my mind, there's no doubt it occurred. And the issue is that the United States Navy has that information. That radar data, the raw data, was not thrown away. So there's a lot of scientific information that could be obtained from that radar data. You know, exactly how did that object move in 0.78 seconds? Was it a linear movement, or was it a, you know, kind of a sudden step type movement? And when the planes engaged the object, what was the radar picking up? And meanwhile, there was also a what they call a Hawkeye aircraft. It's similar to a basically a plane with radar,
right,
in the 24 sky.
24-foot dish on the top.
Yeah, 24-foot dish or so. And it has a lot of electromagnetic information that it captured. So a lot of knowledge could be obtained from this type of information if it could be released to the scientific community to be analyzed.
Mm-hmm. We have a number of questions. One in chat just came in, and you were talking about the camera running out there and you know, getting some footage. And so Lorraine in the chat room wanted to know, how do you know of purposeful upgrades to cameras to capture better footage, and if anyone is working on it? I think she means in the military. Do you know anything about that? I mean, they're pretty sensitive now, right?
Right. They're very sensitive now, and they were sensitive then. Everyone that I talked to, and I interviewed Lieutenant Commander Slate, I interviewed Kevin Day, I interviewed, Jason Turner, and Gary Burris, and all of those guys saw the video on board the USS Princeton. And in the case of Slade, it was on board the USS Nimitz. And every one of them said that the video was of much higher quality that they saw than what has been released.
Oh,
so
I see.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure the video is better quality. As to, you know, what happened, why it is not of the same quality as it was that they originally saw, you know, can't answer that.
That might have been like infrared or something, or some other type of spectrum they were recording in on the one that's available. And
well, then they were both, my understanding is they were both in infrared, but that the infrared video is much more clear than the one that was released.
Too bad they didn't release that one. That's the one we want to see, right?
Yeah. Well, I think it's the same video. I just think the video's been degraded. The other thing that all of the witnesses indicated was the video was much longer than the video that was released. And Commander Slate gave a very good reason for why that would be. Because he said, if you're going into a situation, whether it's combat or whatever, you don't wait until you get into the situation to turn on your recorder. You do that as soon as you leave the ship. And so the video would have begun, but prior to what we are seeing.
Right.
It would have begun as soon as, you know, it started showing up. So the video was clearly cut at some point.
Yeah.
For whatever reason, I don't know.
That question came up to Lou Elizondo, And he said that they will only declassify segments at a time for some reason, and I have no idea why. You know, maybe it's something technological that they don't understand and don't want to release it. You know, who knows what that reason would be for. You mentioned Commander Slate. Also, I know there was a female, I think she was the wingman, and it was her first carrier deployment. And
she was actually the pilot in Slate's aircraft.
Oh, okay. So he was the what's called the Weasel or whatever, the weapons.
Right, yeah. The weapons system officer.
Yeah. She's not talking. Do you know anything about her and why? Is she just, was she terrified? Do you know anything about that?
Well, I know the identification of all of both other pilots, but neither one of them wants to talk. So I honor their privacy, sure. And I have not, you know, I don't intend, the SCU does not intend to violate their privacy. So I would just be speculating as to why she doesn't want to talk. Yeah. I just know she doesn't, and we're honoring that.
Yeah. Now, how early on did I obviously they weren't told to not talk about the incident, which I think is kind of interesting. But and I understand there was some footage on YouTube pretty early on. I don't know for sure if it was Nimitz or what, but it was something similar to that. But when do you know that people started talking about it? I mean, 2004 is quite a, you know, what, 13 years ago, 14 years ago, almost 15. Did people start talking about it right away? Do you have any idea about that?
You know, I would have to go look at our report to give you the exact date, Martin. But I believe it was first talked about in 2007. There were discussions on Above Top Secret, that site.
Mm-hmm.
There were also discussions we found on Facebook back then. And those the former Above Top Secret's kind of a UFO type site, right? The latter on Facebook was on a Navy Facebook site. So that was just basically Navy guys saying, hey, do you remember this? Do you remember what happened? That kind of thing.
So let's talk about your report. Is your report just a factual thing that can be anyone can research, or how does that work?
Well, the report is over 250 pages.
Wow.
A lot of those are appendices. The bulk of the report, the main body, is 20 pages. Mm-hmm. And the appendices basically support the 20 pages that are written.
That's a lot.
And yeah. And so we wrote it basically as much as we could in the way you write a scientific paper. And we've had a peer review within the Scientific Coalition for Ufology, because within our organization, we have multiple PhDs in physics, oceanography, and other areas. And, you know, they're familiar with sending papers out to various journals. So we've written it in that manner.
So it'll be taken more seriously, basically, right?
Right, yeah. We don't, you know, we don't jump to any conclusions. We just kind of state the facts and do calculations based on the information we have available to us. So that's how the paper's written. As far as information, I mean, 99.9% of everything that we have there, we had available to us back in March of 2018, but we've spent this last 9 to 10 months basically writing, developing the paper, and having it peer reviewed within our organization. So it's not like we will be releasing some information no one has heard before. We're just putting it together in a concise package. More or less.
I see. Now, is there, as far as you know, is there any misconceptions about the whole event out there that's like rumors traveling around, or has it been pretty close to factual?
Well, that's a difficult question, because I don't know what all rumors, you know, I avoid somewhat the social media sites because, you know, they're black holes that you can just get sucked down into.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's very little value in that. I'm not aware off the top of my head of any rumors that are necessarily not true. I mean, if you mention some, I could tell you if they're true or not. But
well, I did hear, you know, I personally did hear people were saying the object was above the water, not in the water. And, you know, so that's pretty much put to bed as far as what you talked about. And, you know, more of it's out there that it was something that was under the water and unseen.
Right. I mean, basically, we deal with the object that's above the water.
Mm-hmm.
Because, what is first seen, also by another pilot named Kurth, which I didn't mention earlier, but what's seen, you know, immediately below the water, we don't have a lot of information on other than, you know, a total of three jets that witnessed it. But other than that, that's the only information we have. So we did not spend any time on that. We spent the time on the object that's we have the information on.
And before we went live, I mentioned to you that I heard that's, and I don't know if this is wrong or correct, that it was some people are saying that it was like a cross-like shape in the water. But you don't really know anything about that one way or the other, right?
Right. I don't know for sure what the shape was, and I'm not sure anyone truly does.
Yeah. Okay. So we have a couple of questions that came in. And from Carrie, and this one here is, what is your opinion on how the Tic Tac object seemed to be one step ahead of Commander Fravor by reappearing at the Combat Air Patrol rendezvous location before he arrived there? That was pretty amazing.
Yeah, that's an interesting question, and I should explain a little bit about what the combat area or the cap point, what that refers to. Basically, when you have a carrier strike group, right, that which consists, I guess, as a minimum, of a aircraft carrier, ship similar to the USS Princeton, which is a missile cruiser, and at least two destroyers and a nuclear attack submarine, which in this case was the USS Louisville. So basically, you have that strike group, and they're moving through. And I'm gonna have to apologize, Martin. I've gotten carried away now. So the question, okay, on the cap point. So your F-18 Super Hornets, part of their job is to protect that strike group. So they have four cap points around the carrier strike group, and those are they're not arbitrary, but they're identified by altitude, longitude, and latitude. So you've got these four points, and so you have a squadron around each of those points or a number of jets to protect the group. The location of those cap points is unknown to anyone except those with the need to know, such as the pilots and key personnel on the ships. Well, what happened in this case is that after the incident, the engagement with Commander Fravor and this object, and the object disappears rapidly, he's headed back to the Nimitz when the USS Princeton radios him and says, "You're not going to believe this, but that object is back at your cap point," right? So what's unique in that question is the implication of how did the object know where his cap point was, right? So either it had to know maybe somehow by observing his movement, which I don't think is likely, or two, somehow it intercepted communications, or three, you can get into more speculative things like, well, it read some,
read some.
Who knows? Yeah. But so if you assume that is true, right, that this object went back to the cap point, and that has been stated by Commander Fravor, who received that statement over the radio, and it's, you know, been confirmed by Senior Chief Day, right, who was on the USS Princeton. You have to realize that a cap point is a very small point in terms of you've got this huge amount of operational area that the strike force is working in, right? So for this unknown object to know where the cap point is says that it's like it is telling them, I am aware of what you're doing. I'm aware of your procedures, right? Hmm. It's almost a method of communication. Hmm. It's like, here, I'm going to communicate to you that I know, right? I'm not just an arbitrary point moving through your sky. There is a certain level of intelligence to what I'm doing, right? So I'm not saying that's absolutely what happened, right? Because we don't know. But I'm just saying that question is a good question because it makes you consider that possibility. And at this point in time, all you can say, that's a possibility.
Yeah. Yeah, that is pretty bizarre. The one thing that I'm a little bit confused about is during the exercises they were flying, they talk about that they're armed with something, and they're surprised that they're armed. Do you know anything about that?
No, they're not armed.
They are
not armed. None of the aircraft there are armed. They're near U.S. territorial waters. And as Commander Fravor explained, that would be very unusual for them to be armed while they're doing practices.
Yeah. Then I guess that's one of the things that I heard that is not true.
Right. That's not true. As a matter of fact, Lieutenant Commander Jim Slate indicated they were not armed, and Commander Fravor made a point of saying the only armament he had, he would have to hammer off of his plane because it was a training missile that was attached to his plane and not be fired.
A training missile, okay.
Yeah.
And
there's also a time in some of the documentation where the female pilot, she's concerned because as they're moving into this area, right, and they don't know what they're coming against. They're assuming the possibility that perhaps it's a aircraft, you know, kind of like 9/11, right? Something like that. They have no idea. You know, thoughts are running through their head. That they might have to use their jet as a battering ram, right? Because they don't have weapons.
I see. We just got a couple minutes left until we go into break. And there seems to be a lot of activity in the. They were out toward Catalina Island, not far from it, and it just seems. I mean, now there's even a UFO tour you can take there, and there's been so much activity in that area. That's pretty strange, huh? I mean, going back, I know there was a great film back in the 1960s. I think it was. Do you know if there's is this a constant area of like a what they call a hotspot? Are you aware of that?
Yes, I've got a little bit. I haven't seen the film you referred to, but we have a different project at in the SCU, and that project is we're looking at what you call USOs.
Mm-hmm.
So these are
great
reports of underwater submerged objects.
Yeah,
and so what we've done, we've gone across history from when all this began in 1947 to modern times and plotting only USOs, right? We throw out UFOs, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to do a statistical analysis, so this is very preliminary. So I can't say this is statistically correct other than I look at numbers all the time and I can kind of tell. And I would say that there are two areas in the world where the reports of USOs are very high, and that's Catalina Island and Puerto Rico.
Wow.
Those two areas have many more reports than their population justifies, right?
Mm-hmm.
because normally reports are based on population because people make incorrect reports. So the more people you have in an area, the more UFO reports, the more USO reports.
All right, everyone, thanks so much for listening to the show. This is it for the free part. Anyone can subscribe to the show for $2 or more per month and listen to the full shows. All that information's on podcastufo.com. And you can also do a once-a-year payment. That's all. All that information's there. And I do want to thank you so much for listening. And next week, we have Sam Maranto from Chicago. Always an interesting show. And thanks again, everyone. And remember to keep your eyes to the sky.